From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The things we build and do are becoming more complex. Our networks more connected and dense. And that means more than ever we work in teams. Researchers say that with that evolution comes a new need for collective intelligence and a new culture of collaboration. They say a great team isn't about how smart its members are, it's about how the group works together. This hour On Point, all about the team, the smart team in our workplaces and in our lives. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Are you more than ever working on teams? Is this a new culture you're having to grow into? What have you seen? What makes a great team? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Joining me now are two researchers, members of a team of their own, who've been studying this. Anita Woolley is professor of organizational behavior at the Tepper School of Business at Carnegie Mellon University, joins us from Pittsburgh. Anita, welcome. Thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
And Thomas Malone joins us from Weston, Massachusetts, professor of management at MIT's Sloan School of Management, founding director of the MIT Center for Collective Intelligence. Their essay, co-authored with Christopher Chabris of Union College, ran in the New York Times recently, headlined, Why Some Teams Are Smarter Than Others. You can find a link at our website. It's a culmination of a lot of research they've been doing over the years, especially a study published in the American Association for the Advancement of Science and a study just published in PLOS One. Tom Malone, thank you very much for being with us as well.
Hi, Tom. Great to be here.
Anita, you two, three, kind of say that the way we work together has changed. There's a lot more working together, working in teams, and our culture overall is somehow lagging in keeping up with this reality, that we need to start. We've got a kind of a gap opening up here. What's the problem, Anita?
Well, I think historically the focus has been on understanding the capabilities of individuals. And we, you know, for over a century now have had some pretty good metrics for measuring individual intelligence and individual capability. And consequently, that's been a real focus. But what we're finding is that that is less predictive of collective performance than we may have thought.
Thomas Malone, I have to say, I mean, there must be others like me in the boat where over the years now I've heard so much about team dynamics that part of me just is repelled at getting back into that conversation. At the same time, I see what you're describing, that people are working more and more and more in units, in pods, in teams, and those do not always go well. Is this just the new way? And if it is, why?
Well, I think we are seeing a lot more work in teams. And I agree with you. I sometimes get sick of hearing people talk about all the different ideas about how to do it better. One thing we think is unusual and interesting about what we're doing is that we're trying to be pretty scientific about this, and we're trying to get a way of measuring how smart a team is, not just how well it does any one single task, but how generally capable a team is of doing a lot of different things. So that's one thing we think is interesting about the new direction we've been taking.
I mean, the bottom line, Anita, that I took from your essay in the Times was, okay, you've got a team. I took away sort of two things. Let everybody talk and load it with women. Am I wrong?
That's not incorrect. I would say it's about not only letting everybody talk, but also making sure that there's relatively equal contribution among the members.
Isn't that what letting everybody talk means? Oh, you mean not just let it all talk, but give them about the same amount of time?
Right. So I think commonly in organizations, we do see that hierarchy gets in the way of hearing from all of the members equally. And what our research suggests is that those teams are less smart than they could be.
And why the emphasis on women?
Well, you know, it's funny. We didn't start out originally looking at that as a big variable. In our early studies, we saw a correlation and we thought it might be spurious and didn't pay a whole lot of attention to it. But when we saw it for the fourth and fifth and sixth time, decided we should explore it. And it does seem that having more women in the group does encourage these other behaviors, such as equal airtime, that we know contribute to collective intelligence.
And then there's this whole issue, Thomas Malone, of social sensitivity, mind reading, you call it.
Right. you can call it social perceptiveness, or I actually like to call it social intelligence because I think it's a more general skill. But what we found, as you implied already, we did find that groups that had more women in them tended to score higher on our measure of collective intelligence. But that was mostly explained statistically by the fact that women, on average, have a higher score on this measure of social perceptiveness. Now, we measure this by using a test called reading the mind in the eyes. We let people look at pictures of other people's eyes and try to guess what emotion the person in the picture is feeling. So it turns out that when you have a lot of people in a group who are good at that, the group, on average, is more collectively intelligent than when you don't. Now, we found that that was correlated with having more women in the group, in part because it was known even before our work that women, on average, score higher on this measure of social perceptiveness than men. But one way of interpreting our results is to say that what you really need for a group to be collectively intelligent is to have a bunch of people in the group who are high on this skill of social perceptiveness or social intelligence. And if you have that, then it may not matter much whether the people who have that are men or women. It just so happens that if you know nothing about a person besides their gender, you're more likely to get that with women than with men.
Now, this is interesting. Why, Anita, is social perceptiveness so important here? I can imagine an old school organization saying, we're going to put together a team to do this great thing. We're going to get the smartest people we have, put them all in a room, and, you know, presuming that it's almost the sum of their IQs would come up with the best outcome. You're suggesting there's some other alchemy that goes on a team that really doesn't have to do with the cumulative IQ of those in the room.
That's right. And I think probably all of us can think of examples of groups we've been in that have included very smart individuals, but as a collective, far underperformed what we might have expected. So what we're seeing here is that social perceptiveness, or as Tom was mentioning, social intelligence, really enables the individuals in the group to pick up on subtle cues. And those cues could be transmitted in all kinds of ways, verbal as well as nonverbal, and to do things that then facilitate the work of the group, either by perhaps talking a little less if they notice that someone else hasn't been heard from, or asking questions that draw those people out so that the group can really benefit from the knowledge of all of its members.
Tom, why do these emotional elements, these social cues, matter so much? Why isn't it just a big exchange of ideas and we get to the best one?
Well, first, I think it's important to realize that we did find there was a correlation between the average intelligence of the people in the group and the group's collective intelligence, but it was only a fairly moderate correlation. So just having smart people doesn't necessarily make the group smart. I think another way of thinking about it, and it's almost simplistic to say it this way, but in order to have a group perform effectively, you need to have people in the group who are capable of doing whatever it is that needs to be done, but you also need them to be able to work well together. So no matter how good they are individually, if they can't work effectively together, then the group as a whole is not likely to be able to perform very effectively. So we think this measure of social perceptiveness or social intelligence is actually a measure not just of the specific ability to read people's emotions in their eyes, but we think it's a measure that's correlated with a much broader range of interpersonal skills. The ability to understand what's going on in other people's minds, to predict what they'll say if you say such and such. So when you think of it that way, it's not at all surprising that having that kind of interpersonal skill among the people in the group would help the group be more effective.
So there's a kind of presumption here that if you get this group together, there's some sort of buried insights there which may not come to the fore if the social dynamics aren't good. I guess that's what you're saying here, Anita.
That's certainly part of it. One thing that can happen is that someone in the group may know the answer, but because of the group dynamics, that person never gets a chance to say what they know. But there are, I think, a lot of more complicated and more interesting things that can happen as well. For instance, it could be that to really get the problem solved, you need to have contributions from three or four different people, and they need to figure out how they're going to do that and not have one dominate the other when the other one knows better, but then 2 minutes later, it may be the other way that you need to let somebody take the lead. So I think there's a whole broad range of interpersonal skills that people who are high on this measure of social intelligence have more of than others. And when you have a lot of that in a group, the group is just more effective.
Anita, I can imagine some listeners sitting and thinking, you know, this sounds like a team that's just sitting around being nice instead of getting in there, you know, and really working on a problem, breaking the china if need be to get through to some great outcome, Anita.
No, I'd say if people are taking that away, they probably misunderstand our research. So one thing that's important to note is that in our initial paper that came out in Science a few years ago, we did measure things about group relationships such as cohesion, satisfaction, motivation, and we actually found very little correlation between those things and collective intelligence. So this is not really about group members liking each other. What it is about is getting the most from every group member. And certainly there would be less conflict in a group, perhaps, if you hear less from certain individuals because you're less likely to bring out disagreements and debate. If you hear from all people and they are sharing the full range of their knowledge and expertise, you're much more likely to get some friction, but that could turn into creative friction and could be quite good for the group.
You all say the day of the lone genius is over. I want to look at that. But if the team is the way of the future and if women... Yes, men can do this, but if on balance, if you have to choose blind, choose women and you're more likely to get there, what does that say for the future of men in the workplace, Anita?
Well, first, I also want to clarify, we're continuing to look at, is this a linear relationship? Is it a curvilinear relationship? And we're finding actually that the majority of women in the group, but not all women, is actually the best composition. So certainly there's a role for everybody.
But I'm looking at New York Times. Teams with more women outperform teams with more men. That's pretty black and white as you all have published it to the world. Anita Woolley, please stand by in Pittsburgh. Thomas Malone in Weston, Massachusetts. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about teamwork. Our offices, our workplaces, our lives are full of it now. And what makes good teams? Thomas Malone is with us from MIT's Sloan School of Management. Anita Woolley is with us from Pittsburgh. She's out of the Tepper School of Business at Carnegie Mellon University. They've been doing a lot of research on what works for collective intelligence, good teams. Lots of response here. Britt says, women, yes. Ronnie says, every successful team needs a designated heretic and paranoid whose job it is to pretend everyone else in the group is naive and to come up with only heretical counterthoughts to the current consensus. We know that type. Mike, Anita and Tom respond, looking forward to this conversation, says, it looks like the discussion of teams is going to be used as another vehicle for launching a third wave attack on men. It's getting old. Let me ask you about this message from one of our listeners. Leonard writes to us, and he says, you all were saying earlier with my producer that in the 50s, maybe 50% of work was done in teams, and now maybe more like 90%. Leonard says, if in fact we're more engaged in teamwork today than in the 50s, then we might need to question the value of teamwork. We certainly aren't doing better now than we were then. Our quality of life is lower. Our community is more fractured. We're more isolated, less satisfied, and so on and on. Maybe teamwork isn't the answer, Leonard writes. Maybe we should consider returning to a greater emphasis on individual creativity and intellectual activity and leave the more herd-oriented team approach to sports. Tom Malone, what do you say?
Well, there are a lot of ways of measuring whether life is better or worse now than it was in the 50s.
Yes.
You can certainly pick some ways.
And it may depend on where you sit, too.
Exactly. I think in some sense, the deeper thing that's happening is that we have new kinds of communication technology starting many decades ago with things like telephone, but now really symbolized by the Internet. And these communication technologies make it cheaper, easier, and much more feasible for more people to communicate with more other people. That means we're able to assemble larger groups of people to take on bigger tasks so we can do things that we could never have done before. I think whether you like all of those things or not is a separate question, but I think it's pretty amazing what we're able to do these days, and we couldn't do it without larger and larger groups of people working together, sometimes sitting in a room, sometimes coordinated through a whole organization or through something like the Wikipedia site on the internet. So all these things are examples of new ways of doing bigger, in many cases better, and more complex things.
Of course, one of the people who made those things possible, or at least popular, was Steve Jobs. What about this exchange? This is the 2013 biopic, Jobs. He's played by Ashton Kutcher here. He's, in this little bit, he's getting frustrated with a colleague while working for Alan Alcorn of Atari.
You refuse to do anything that vaguely escapes your comfort zone.
You're not even my boss.
Well, I damn sure should be.
Hey, Jobs. What are you doing, Steve?
He's an idiot. You know, and half the people around here don't know how to design.
People are complaining about your behavior. You gotta learn how to work well with other people.
I'm just trying to do it right,
Al. I know you are. Listen, Steve, you're good. You're damn good. But you're
Ashton Kutcher channeling Steve Jobs there. Anita Woolley, is this the great counterexample? I mean, he must have been hell on a team, but he built Apple.
Well, and I think even in the example we were listening to, he actually was listening to what the other person had to say.
Sort of.
And certainly at Apple, we know that there are also some very good teams that are maybe not behind the prominent leader who started the whole enterprise, but certainly are contributing a lot to the technology. It's pretty common that we want to make attributions to leaders, to lone individuals, about the success or failure of an enterprise, of an economy, of whatever we're evaluating. But often there are good teams behind them, and I think that's certainly the case at Apple.
We've got a lot of callers for you. We're going to hear some pushback on this whole perspective as well in a moment. But first, our callers, Charleston, South Carolina. David's calling. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom, how are you? I'm talking to you on a Samsung phone, which everybody knows
okay.
Uses both phones. It's much superior than the rant-produced Apple phone.
Okay.
But what I wanted to, I guess, my initial question was, yes, the problem with smart people is that they're very aggressive and that the efforts of a very aggressive smart person tend to drive out everybody else's effort as sort of the principle of displaced effort. But what I have found in a couple of very, very disparate projects is that if you have one or more very smart people who are not the experts on the subject at hand, that helps an awful lot because they can actually become the audience, a fair-minded audience, to which all the people who are really expert on the problem can appeal. And then they can, if they're very emotionally intelligent, they can manipulate the experts in a way that produces successful consensus.
That is very interesting, David. Let us pick it up. Tom Malone, what do you make of that formulation? It's worked for David.
I think that's an interesting idea. I think that's one of many things that can work in different situations and can often work well. Sometimes we call that the bystander role, that somebody who's not kind of engaged in one side or the other of the argument can play a very important role in leading the group toward productive working together.
Bring in a couple of high IQ individuals, and yet you're also looking for that collective intelligence here. Maybe that helps. Anne Shrewsbury, Vermont. Anne, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm wanting to inject another idea here, and that is about personality type. And I'm sure the people on the panel there are familiar with the Myers-Briggs personality type indicator.
Your ENTJs and all the rest. Yeah, sure.
That's right. And mm-hmm. So I have learned about it 30 years ago, and it's made a world of difference in how I approach people and work with people. I'm a teacher, so I'm constantly working with people. And I'll just be brief, but the four categories are introversion, extroversion, and these are all how an individual perceives the world and mm-hmm. prefers making decisions.
Mm-hmm.
So introversion, extroversion, and then whether you tend to be intuitive or sensing, and sensing is more kind of data-driven. And then the third one is whether you tend to be primarily thinking or feeling. And the fourth category is whether you tend to be perceiving or judging. And perceiving people are just always wanting to be open to possibilities, and people with judging are not just necessarily judgmental, but are looking for a path and a goal and closure.
And what's your notion, Anne, that if you put together the right recipe, the right ingredients of a mix of those, you'll get the best team?
I think so. And I think also the awareness, if each individual in the team has done this sort of, you know, done the questionnaire or and has awareness of how each person operates, you know, prefers to operate, it really helps people accepting each other for the gifts that they have. And I have heard of organizations that do have the entire staff take the questionnaire and get educated about it. It's just great. Like, I just know that I have most trouble relating to people who are primarily sensing and people who process intuitively. That just connects for me much more. So that's good for me to know. But sensing people get things done. So anyway, I thought your people there might want to comment on that.
Yes, absolutely. And thank you. Anita Woolley, what about personality types, Myers-Briggs and all the rest? Did you pay attention to that? What's your response to Anne's view there?
Certainly. So in the studies that we've run thus far, we've actually used a slightly different personality indicator known as the Big Five. And that's one that's more commonly used in the research arena. But it lines up very well with Myers-Briggs, and I'm familiar with the Myers-Briggs typology. We found very little correlation at the group level with particular personality traits and collective intelligence. But I do hear the caller's point, and my interpretation of what she's describing is that for her, the Myers-Briggs is another window to enhance her own social perceptiveness in interpreting what other people are doing in a way that enables her to work with them more effectively. So I think in that vein, it can be hugely helpful. But we didn't find any systematic relationship between how collectively intelligent a group is and the personality of its members.
Though, Tom Malone, this does go back in a way to social perceptiveness and saying sort of understand the makeup of your fellow team members and you may be better further down the road.
Yeah, certainly that's consistent with what we're saying. What we looked at, what Anita was just saying, we looked at the average scores of the team members on the different personality types, and we found no simple correlation there. But it is possible, as I think the caller was implying, that some combination of personality types may help a team be more effective. We haven't actually looked at that. I think it's an interesting question.
Let's kick this whole thesis around a little harder here. Tom Malone, Anita Woolley, please stand by. Maury Schechtman joins us right now from Kalispell, Montana. He's founder of Fifth Wave Leadership. It's a management consulting firm. He's worked with Facebook and a lot of corporations on developing productive teams. He's teaching an MBA program at the University of Montana. He thinks creative tension is the key to successful teams. Maury Schechtman, thank you very much for being with us.
Glad to be here.
Okay, you're not a shrinking violet. You read the essay in the New York Times that Anita and Tom put forward, and you said there's nothing in it that's useful in actually conducting a meeting and getting something done. Why?
Right. Everything I've been listening to isn't even at 30,000 feet. It's at 100,000 feet. Teams work effectively together when you personalize the interactions, and until you do, they'll be much too long and much too unproductive.
Personalize the interactions. What does it mean, Maury?
Yeah. There are two levels of tension in every team meeting, task tension and relationship tension.
Okay.
If you don't lower the relationship tension, you're going to waste an inordinate amount of time and have people guessing through the whole meeting. So we start every meeting with our clients with a personal, professional check-in. You get 3 to 5 minutes to talk about how your life has been in the last week or the last 30 days. Soon as you do that, you increase participation, and you get things done faster. But most meeting time in businesses in America is spent on people guessing about where their colleagues are coming from. Okay? And a lot of what I heard your guest talking about just makes the guessing worse. Okay? So you don't need to be guessing. People need to tell you what's been going on in their life. As soon as they do, every other variable becomes fairly irrelevant.
Well, but
everyone pitches in.
I get that. So you say sort of lay your stuff out on the table, your baggage, what's going on in your life, and then go to the task. But speak to the pillars of a high collective intelligence team as laid out here. Equal participation and high social perceptiveness and maybe more women.
Right. Effective professionals are no brighter than anybody else. And in fact, it often gets in their way. Gender is an issue in leadership at times. It is irrelevant in the effectiveness of teams. Women and men both struggle with self-disclosure, and once they get into it, they're more effective. But the pillars I heard about have nothing to do with my experience, 35 years of working with corporate teams. Right? And we have a lot of success in doing that. In an information-intensive culture, who you are personally is a prime determinant of productive behavior.
I mean,
not how smart you are or where you've been educated.
No, and I think they agree on that front, but they put a very high value on social perceptiveness. You've said the team is there to confront each other, not support each other. Supportive teams are BS. They get nothing done. What do you mean?
Right. Yeah, all that happens when you get the traditional supportive stuff is that people help each other stay in denial about what's going on. Right? And consensus is just the road to mediocrity. What you want is buy-in. Buy-in means I don't have to agree with everything you want to do as a team, but it doesn't sufficiently offend my values that I can't do it. And if it does sufficiently offend your values time and time again, you're in the wrong company and you need to move on. Consensus is a killer.
Anita Woolley, when you talk about social perceptiveness as being very important in a team's function, Anita, do you mean that this will be a supportive team or that even in the midst of conflict, the people will be paying attention to what's going on?
More the latter. So I think we're not saying anything that's very different than Maury is. Social perceptiveness is not about being soft and kind. It's about picking up on cues. And so certainly having a check-in is one way to make cues very salient to other team members to know where everybody is coming from. And in my own experience, both in consulting and in research and organizations, I agree completely that that is a great way to get teams off on the right track. What our studies suggest is that those who have this particular capability to pick up on very subtle cues will go up the learning curve in figuring out where their team members are at all that much more quickly, and especially when they don't have the benefit of a check-in. So I don't think we're saying anything different, and certainly we're not saying it implies that a team then experiences no conflict, does not challenge one another, et cetera.
Tom Malone, Maury says, you know, conflict is necessary for a good team, and conflict avoidance is a huge problem in American business. Is your high social perceptiveness looking to escape conflict?
No, I think Anita already said it, that being socially perceptive certainly does not mean that you never disagree with someone. I think someone who's high on social perceptiveness, or as we now know from our second study, that it's actually a much broader skill than that. People who are high on that skill could be effective at conflict and at disagreement as well. In fact, I also like the suggestion Maury had about doing a check-in. We do that in a number of the groups I participate in, and one thing we've even thought about is doing some experiments using our collective intelligence measure to see whether groups that do a check-in at the beginning of their meetings are, in fact, more effective at a lot of different tasks. I think it's an interesting hypothesis. We don't know for sure whether it's true, but it could well be.
Check-in. Maury Shechtman, I'm not sure why I want to know about how your weekend picnic went before we dive in on the business at hand.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you why. Because then you know why I'm acting the way I am, and you're not guessing. And I would ask your guests, what in the world does social perceptiveness mean? Okay, it sounds like nice academic jargon.
Wait a minute. Maury, you and I mean, some people are kind of boorish and pay no attention to what's going on around them, aren't reading signals from others. I'm sure you read signals from others.
If you read them, what does that have? What are you going to do with that when you read them?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about what makes good teams or good teamwork. It's become more and more important in our lives. Anita Woolley and Thomas Malone, along with Christopher Chabris, have been writing about this, doing some big studies. One in the New York Times recently headlined Why Some Teams Are Smarter Than Others. They join us today. Maury Shechtman joins us from Kalispell, Montana, with Fifth Wave Leadership. He's done a lot of work with corporations on the leadership front as well. A little different perspective on what's going on. this social perceptiveness issue is on the table. Maury's not so sure about it, but I want to ask Anita, you and Tom one question first, then I'll come right to it, Maury. But Jonathan writes to us, and he hears your recipe here. Get equal participation from people or close to it. Have people who can read the mind well. Have women, because they're good on social perceptiveness. And Jonathan writes, thank you for reinforcing gender stereotypes. Just because you're female does not equate to social perception or emotional IQ and empathy. Anita, what do you say to that?
Well, there are kind of two ways to think about it. First, I think Tom made a very good point earlier about really what we're focusing on is the individual capabilities to communicate and to facilitate collaboration, which can be present in both men and women. But the empirical fact, not only based on our research, but based on much broader studies in the population, is that on average, women tend to score a bit higher in measures of this, and it translates into more effective collaboration. But again, if you had a way of knowing who had these skills and who didn't, and you simply composed a group of individuals who had these skills in greater quantity, you'd have a good group, whether it was all male or all female.
Scott's ready to buy the whole package. He says, he writes to us on Twitter, everyone talks, everyone contributes, and load it with women. Exactly why Congress doesn't work and how to start fixing it. Tom Malone, Maury Scheckman says social perceptiveness, he doesn't even see why it's relevant or why it matters here. Maury, could you elaborate on that so Tom and Anita might respond more effectively? What do you mean, Maury?
Yeah, it sounds like more game playing to me. So when I still don't know what social perceptiveness means, reading people, this is all reinforcing the guessing that goes on, that drags out meetings. I don't want to guess. I want to know where you're coming from. And if last week was the worst week in your life, it's good for me to know that. Then I know why you're acting the way you are. But I don't want to spend my time trying to figure out where people are coming from. I want them to tell me in the first 5 minutes of a meeting. Then you can get down to business very fast. Otherwise, you're going to waste a lot of highly paid time, which most companies do.
Of course, there may be more than what happened last week going on. I'm sure there is. It's what happened over a lifetime. But Tom Malone, social perceptiveness, what's it mean? Why does it matter?
So first, let me respond to the point that was being made just a couple of minutes ago, which is that even though it's true that women on average score a little higher on this test of social perceptiveness than men, it's certainly not the case that all women are higher on it than all men. If you think of an analogy, it's kind of like height. That is, on average, men are taller than women, but there's certainly some women who are taller than some men and vice versa. So I think social perceptiveness is similar here. They're overlapping distributions, as you would say if you were a statistician. Now, to the question of what it actually means, we did have a very precise meaning of it in what we measured, which was, as I said earlier, showing people pictures of other people's eyes and asking them to guess what emotion the person in the picture was feeling. So that's the precise operational definition of what we measured. But what we found in a later study, the one you mentioned at the beginning, Tom, that was just published in PLOS One, was that when we had groups, we had some groups who interacted with each other face-to-face and other groups who interacted with each other online. And the only way the online groups could communicate was by typing to each other.
Okay.
They only saw what each other was typing.
Yep.
What we found was this measure of social perceptiveness was an equally strong predictor of how collectively intelligent the groups would be in both cases.
With no eye reading. So it's not really eye reading that's your bottom line.
It's something much bigger than eye reading, exactly. So the people who were scored higher on this test were also better at communicating with each other when all they could do was type.
Why does it matter? So now, let's say for whatever reason, I'm more empathic, I understand you better. Take us further down that line of thinking. Why does it matter in terms of the efficacy of the team?
Right. Well, so what I think it means is that the thing that the test is measuring is actually correlated with a broader set of interpersonal skills. It turns out that one of those things you have, if you're good at this, is being able to read people's emotions in their eyes. But I think what it also implies is that you're good at a bunch of other things about getting along with other people. You're good at predicting how they're going to respond if you say something. You're good at knowing how to say it so they'll respond in the way you want. You're good at doing a bunch of things like that, and that I think those interpersonal skills, or you could call it social intelligence, those are clearly things that help groups work better. I think, in fact, this test we used of reading the mind in the eyes was originally developed as a test of autism. So people who have autism score very poorly on that test, and if you imagine a stereotypical autistic person, you kind of know what it would mean to be really bad at it. But it turns out there's a big variation on that test even among normal people, which we think is correlated with this much broader range of interpersonal skills.
Maury, I would think that would matter even to you. You talk about getting buy-in on a team, and it helps to understand the way the cut of the jib of team members to get that, doesn't it?
No, it means people being honest, absolutely honest, straight with mm-hmm. each other and with the group as a whole. And I've got to tell you, this is so far off the rails for me that I don't know what to say after a while, because I still don't get an answer to this social perceptiveness, what it means. And this is still about having people doing a lot of guessing. And that just doesn't work. You know, I'm working with thousands of teams in 35 years, and this discussion has little to do with why they function well or why they don't. It's all about who people are. Information-intensive cultures are about who people are personally. This is all theory.
Okay. Tom, here we have, I mean, in a way, we four constitute a team right now, and here's a tension, and...
Yeah.
Maury, Tom, is essentially saying this is mumbo-jumbo. And so, team member, you can't see his eyes. You can't even see him tapping on a computer. But how do you respond to this effectively? Maybe I should ask Anita, but I'll ask you first, Tom.
Well, I think I'd try to understand where Maury is coming from. We have actually explained several times what our official kind of measuring technique was for social perceptiveness, and he keeps saying he doesn't understand it, so... I guess I would try to understand better where Maury is coming from. Maybe he's trying to make the broadcast more interesting by having some conflict here, and sounds like it's working.
Anita, is there a sort of old world view of team that you hear Maury expressing, or just a different experience, different bottom line?
A little bit of both. So I don't hear Tom or I saying anything to. Contradict what he's suggesting, which is that getting the information straight from the other team members and not guessing would always be more beneficial. We're just moving into this world where collaboration is taking place across great distances, across cultures, across time zones. Sometimes it's asynchronous. It's not always possible to know exactly where everybody's coming from at every moment. There's a lot of interpretation that needs to happen. When you send an email and you don't hear back, you can have all kinds of interpretations for why that's occurring. If you're typing a chat message and somebody is responding, in a very short, curt way, mm-hmm. you can have all kinds of interpretations. And what our studies suggest and what my experience suggests is that people who have these capabilities are more effective at making those interpretations in a way that is productive for the team.
Maury, is your experience possibly coming out of a more old school environment, more hierarchical, less densely networked? Could that make a difference here?
No, it had nothing to do with what I'm talking about, no. In fact, it's new world. It's saying, essentially, if you're going to have a new, well-functioning team with people who are highly successful, who they are is the critical issue, not what they know and not all this game playing that your experts are suggesting. Simply means let's find out where everyone in the room's coming from. That lowers relationship tension and keeps task tension high. Then we get everyone's feelings out on the table. There's going to be conflict. That's a clarifier. And then you move into what's the sense of most people about what we ought to do, and can you buy into it? Not that complicated. And all this other stuff is off the rails.
Can I ask Maury a question?
Yes, please, Tom. Fire away.
Maury, do you think some people are better at doing what you just described than others?
No. No, we're not better at self-disclosure. We can be, some people can be uptight about it, takes them a little longer to do it, but our clients get into this in two meetings max, wide open, and they cut the meeting time in half, and they get a whole lot more done. This is not a cognitive skill. This is personally, are you ready to tell people where you're coming from so they're not guessing why you contribute very little? They know why you contribute very little. You just went through the worst week in your life, or you've had the best week of your life.
You're saying
I don't have to guess.
Anymore. You're saying that everybody is equally good at the skill of doing that, the ability to do that, the willingness to do that?
Yeah, it's not a skill in the traditional sense.
It's a skill in a non-traditional sense, but you think everyone is equally good at it?
At disclosure, after a short while, yes.
You're
simply talking about how you feel about your life now. And if I don't know that, there's a hidden agenda throughout the whole meeting that slows it down.
Maurice Shechtman, we've got it. You use that technique right up front, and you say that's kind of the magic bullet here. I want to get to more of our listeners, but I'm grateful to you for joining us, Maury, from Kalispell, Montana, and Fifth Wave Leadership. Thank you so much, Maury.
Mm-hmm.
Karen in Marlborough, Massachusetts. Karen, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Two things. One, it sort of relates to what Maury was saying, and I was wondering, do the researchers, what is their research pool of subjects like in terms of their education level? And I'd be interested to find out, or I know Maury's up here now, but if he's sort of really dealing with a very professional group of people, or this is cuts across a very, very wide socioeconomic group.
Karen, let us pick it up. Our time is short. Maury's worked with a lot of corporations all over the place and very big ones. Anita Woolley, what about in your studies? Does the educational level of team members matter?
So we've conducted our studies in a broad range of subject populations. In the studies that were mentioned in the New York Times piece, we were recruiting from the community, from a broad range of the community. So we had all, sorts of educational levels. We've also done these studies with executives, with students in professional schools, et cetera.
But my question's a little different. In terms of collective intelligence, if you stacked up all the degrees of a team, would you have a good clue to how effective it might be, or is it not so important?
No, it doesn't seem to be as important, according to our research.
Bill in Newport News, Virginia. Bill, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Listen, I spent 22 years in the United States Navy, 16 of them on submarines. If you want to find a team, go find a submarine crew. They are dependent upon each other. They know each other and are aware that this guy is having a bad day or this guy is having a good day. And that's different educational levels. As a civilian, I went out and led teams and managed teams.
Mm-hmm.
And very frankly, the best team leaders I had in small teams doing computer development were women, because they were quite aware of who is in a good mood, who's not in a good mood, who can be trusted today, who can be trusted tomorrow, mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. So leadership is caring for your people
mm-hmm.
and giving them the responsibility and the authority that they need.
Hey, Bill, let me ask you, how did that work on your submarines? Well, you said you found the best teams ever. I doubt there were many women there, maybe none.
No, that's right. It was when I came into civilian life that I found, and it was all in the computer industry, developing software. So that's what my limitation is in what I've seen. But even when I got off of the submarine and into things like the submarine base crews and such,
yeah.
The women were doing very, very well there in the leadership positions that they had. But of course, this was many years ago, and they didn't have very much leadership at that time.
Bill, I really appreciate your calling. Great teams under the sea on submarines. Tom Malloy, your research is kind of suggesting that our culture is lagging behind where it needs to be on organizing for the team life that lies ahead of us, that we sort of have knee-jerk ways of going into teams that maybe we ought to reshape a little bit. How would you advise reshaping?
Well, I think the bottom line is, as I was suggesting earlier, new communications technologies like what we're using right now, in fact, and all kinds of things on the web and so forth, are making it possible to communicate much more easily, much more quickly all over the world. And it's making it possible to share lots more information with lots more people. And what that is doing, I think, is making the old hierarchical way of coordinating things less useful. Not that it's becoming unuseful everywhere, but now a more networked, more decentralized way of coordinating things is becoming more useful in more situations. And I think our mental models, and in many cases our actual organizations, haven't caught up with these new possibilities enabled by these new technologies.
Anita, do you think we'll look back in a few decades and think, oh, we were barbaric back then, we're much more empathic, better team players now?
I certainly hope so.
There's a hope. Maybe there's a need. Terrific to have you both. Anita Woolley at the Tepper School of Business at Carnegie Mellon University. Anita, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
And Thomas Malone at MIT Sloan School of Management, the MIT Center for Collective Intelligence there. Tom Malone, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Our thanks as well to Maury Scheckman in Kalispell, Montana. Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. Thanks for joining us today. This is On Point.